The trustee of Indiana's second largest township is very concerned about the alarming rising rate of sexual abuse among children across the country as well as in the Hoosier State, and he's doing something about it. He certainly created a great public awareness campaign entitled No More Secrets. We have North Township Trustee Frank Mervan with us. Frank, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking to talk about this.
Thank you very much, and we appreciate you, Chris, taking time to handle such a important subject.
What prompted you to be alarmed enough that you wanted to do something about this idea of child sex abuse, not only in Indiana, but maybe even across the country?
There's three reasons that drives me, and one is there was an editorial in the Hammond Times in September of 2015 that showed Indiana was the second highest in the nation as far as reported child sexual assaults. And more importantly, of that, Lake County was number one in the state of Indiana. So the CDC, after further review, shows the Center for Disease Control shows that one in four girls are sexually abused and one in six boys. And if this was Ebola or if this was the flu, it'd be considered an epidemic. So that's on what I learned through the newspaper. But on a personal level, I've been touched by this. As a trustee, we see many clients who come through, and they have shared with me that some of the reasons they have been incapable of working is because they were abused as a child, and they have PTSD, or they have substance abuse issues, or they have just the inability to cope with other people based on that abuse. And on a personal level, I've seen the devastation of a family. My wife and sister-in-law were abused, and my wife is a survivor and has done very well. She's a successful pharmaceutical consultant for Bristol-Myers Squibb, and she is an oncology specialist and sells chemotherapy to physicians. And her sister did not have the same fate. She had PTSD. She suffered from depression. Never was able to get the help that she needed and turned to opiates and is no longer with us. So with that, that is my driving force, because the survivors that I have talked to, their number one goal is that they wish they had someone educate them about personal body safety and inappropriate behavior by adults, and more importantly, that they are a voice for children to try and help them stop the suffering.
Where'd you come up with the No More Secrets title for the program, the campaign?
We have a consultant with us who's helped us put this comprehensive campaign together, and she had put on a play when she was 22 years old, and it was just titled Secrets. And when we got together, her name is Isha Haley. She's a very astute, accomplished woman who has been suffering with this since she was 7 years old. And she came together, and we just thought about how everyone keeps it a secret. What people need to know, predators will do everything they can in their power to keep the victim quiet, either by shaming them or by threatening them or, for example, telling them it'll break up the family or no one will believe you. And while we're in the schools this week with trained mental advocates and also Fairhaven, who is a rape crisis advocate for Lake County, and Child Protective Services, our main message is that any adult who has a relationship with a child who tells them to keep something a secret, that should not be, especially if it's a bad secret. So the campaign came up with statistics and data and outcome that if we can get people talking about awareness, education would be key, and beginning to communicate with kids is the first step.
In fact, you mentioned about going into the schools here, and you've been very, very busy this week, I understand, with these presentations and appearances all across the area, talking with young people in schools and in other settings as well about how this can affect their lives, but they don't have to live with it, that they can work their way through it. And I guess this is all leading up, I understand, to a very interesting symposium that is scheduled for this coming weekend. Tell us about that, please.
The symposium is in Hammond at Purdue Northwest at the auditorium, and you can go online to www.northtownship.com. It's March 18th from 11 to 2. Our main goal there is we are bringing in Erin she's from Naperville, Erin Marin, and she has advocated across the country. She's 26 years old, and she was molested as a child twice, once by a neighbor and once by a family member. And she has gone and created in 26 states a uniform law that would allow for school districts to be able to educate kids. And see how that component is important is State Senator Frank Mervan, my father, Senator Messmer, and now Representative Olthoff from Crown Point is carrying it in the House, where we're trying to change policy. We have Senate Bill 355 that is working with our comprehensive campaign that will make it mandatory to have a curriculum in school for at least 1 or 2 hours every year to talk about child sexual assault, molestation, and more importantly, adult inappropriate behavior, and more topically, sexting, and also sending inappropriate photographs on in the internet. Kids today have phones, they have Facebook, they have Snapchat, and young people are sending pictures, inappropriate pictures back and forth. And we have the U.S. District Attorney's Office of Northwest Indiana and Prosecutor Carter joining us, talking to these kids about the importance of not sending those pictures, and if they receive them, to immediately delete them and get rid of them, and letting them know that there are bad people in the internet world who are posing as their friends and they're really not. And so it is all relative to be able to have child safety. But the symposium is coming together of child care providers, law enforcement, parents, adults. We have the U.S. District Attorney's Office talking about digital imagery and the internet. We have Erin is going to tell her story and talk about the piece of legislation that we have. And we have advocate groups that are going to talk about survivors and what they can do to try and overcome this. And more importantly, it is an awareness of experts coming together to try and eliminate child sexual abuse.
Now, once this symposium gets underway and finishes up here over the weekend there in Hammond, this obviously is a topic that's not ever going to go away. What are you going to do to be able to keep the No More Secrets campaign going here as you keep busy with it and with the time that you spend as the North Township Trustee and all the other tasks you have to do?
Well, right now we have reached, in day three, we have reached over 5,000 kids. And so when it's all over, said and done, the following week we're in the elementary schools. We also have been invited to Portage, and we also have been invited to Fort Wayne. So the panel will continue. The overall reaching goal and what we're trying to do in the comprehensive plan is to change legislation so school districts will be mandated that they have to do this going forward throughout the whole state of Indiana. There will be in the curriculum for every year they will have to provide this K through 5th grade and also 8th grade through 12th to be able to talk about and have mature conversations and talk to kids about predators and how they groom kids and the risks and being educated. So you have the policy that will change it that will always have this dialogue because the schools will have to do that and they'll have to create a clear pathway for if a child wants to tell someone that they can go to the social worker in the school or they can go to the teacher. And then in Indiana, it is a mandatory report state. So then Child Protective Services would come in to help protect those kids. Mm-hmm. Also, we are going to continue this campaign year after year after year with the No More Secrets just to be a facilitator and be able to help train people so that they can educate these kids. And then we have a support group that is put together by Regional Mental Health and Fairhaven survivors can go to, and there's also a hotline by Child Protective Services that has been established that if something is going on, they can call so a child can get out of a bad environment, or a parent, or anyone who needs to have that hotline that can help or advocate for a child. So we have awareness, we have education, we're changing policy, and we're also putting up support groups. So it's very comprehensive, and that is an infrastructure that we want to put in place going forward so that it is nothing ignored. And through this whole process, what I have learned, the best weapon against the skilled predator is education.
We've been talking with North Township Trustee Frank Mervan, who has created the No More Secrets campaign. based on some information he learned, very alarming information about the growing problem of child sexual abuse in Northwest Indiana. And he is taking that program around Northwest Indiana as well as across the state. And that in turn is turning into a bill that is now up before state legislators in Indianapolis. Frank, thank you very much for being with us to talk about this today. We appreciate taking time to tell us about this. And we hope that many people take advantage of the symposium that's going to be scheduled in Hammond this coming weekend to find out more, and hope to hear more about the No More Secrets campaign in the near future.
Chris, I thank you very much for your time, and I appreciate you taking time to cover such an important subject.
In East Chicago, several groups have been formed to help residents in dealing with the lead crisis in that city. And Lakeshore Public Radio's Stephen Lattimore reports that residents are making progress, but things are far from improved.
The Community Strategy Group advocates for residents affected by lead in East Chicago. Their latest meeting was about water filters. Which one to get and how do they work? Reverend Cheryl Rivera.
So our concern was that, you know, there were 18 homes in the Superfund site that tested extremely high for lead in the water. And the EPA has also said that 90% of the homes in East Chicago, the drinking water is contaminated with lead. And so the water filters, as you could see, were a major concern.
An expert spoke at the meeting who is one of four certified industrial hygienists in Indiana. He says the best device to get is reverse osmosis. It goes under the sink. They eliminate 50% of the lead in water. Regular water filters don't work, according to him. You need to find a filter that is also certified for lead. Lead is also airborne. The expert suggests getting a HEPA filter, which is freestanding, or you can put it on the furnace and it will remove 99% of the lead in the air.
What we found out also was that I asked the question, who currently has a filter? There were only about three people in there that had water filters. I asked who had air filters. Only one person had that.
People like David Rodriguez are coping the best way he can.
They help when you first put them in, and then you notice day by day, about a week later, they start going bad because of the what's coming out of there. They only help out a certain point to where if you even buy an expensive one, I bought a 41 that they were talking about, the 40-something dollar one, it was the same results, you know, so we're sticking with a bottle of water.
Melinda Sanchez is concerned about her family.
It's impacting me because I have three children in the home, and we drank that water for everything and done everything with it, so I'm concerned about my children. Right now I'm buying my own, just buying gallons of water, cooking with it. Everything I do that we're ingesting with that water, we're buying it. It's awful. You know, it's just a bad experience to think that you have your kids and your family in a good neighborhood and then all this happens.
Another issue is the vulnerable population of the elderly, people like Adam Jones, who's lived in East Chicago for 47 years.
What concerned me most is, has this been going on for 47 years? I've been there 47 years, and now all of a sudden, ever since this thing started in West Calumet, now it's a big problem. No, I haven't been tested. So I'm going to get tested for lead. See how that comes out. I think I'm going to do that. Me and my wife, we're going to do that. Plus, I'm going to have tell my children to get tested because, you know, even though they're up and gone to another state, they were raised there.
The Community Strategy Group and Reverend Rivera are working towards getting the residents of East Chicago health care for life.
I'm getting a sense that people are hearing us and help us on the way. We're using a case that happened in Libby, Montana, where they were able to get Medicare for life, okay, because that community was poisoned by vermiculite. So it's something in other construction, okay? And so because our community has been poisoned by the contaminants of lead and arsenic, and many of these things will be long-term, we're saying they need health care for life, and that's what we want.
In East Chicago, Stephen Lattimore, Lakeshore Public Radio.
We recently carried Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brozier's report about undocumented Midwest residents being taken to the Immigration and Naturalization Service detention centers before being flown out of the country, some of them flying out of the Gary Chicago International Airport. There is a concern on how children are being cared for in these detention facilities. I talk with a Houston pediatrician, Dr. Fernando Stein, a native of Guatemala, who is leading a national effort to ensure that ICE does more to protect vulnerable children from being, as he put it, re-traumatized.
I am president of the American Academy of Pediatrics, representing 66,000 pediatricians. And for our profession, children are children. And the Academy has taken the position that children deserve our compassion and assistance. Children should never be separated from their parents or caregivers, except when the parent or caregiver is a threat to them. Children should never be placed in detention centers. And finally, all children in the United States should have access to health care, education, and other essential services.
What have you been told in your region there? And I know it would be the same up here in ours here in the Chicago area where we're located, because there is a detention center nearby. In fact, a lot of these people that are being sent back to Mexico and other communities are flying out of the Gary Chicago International Airport here in Lake County, Indiana. What are some folks telling you that the word's getting back to you on how these children are being treated?
It is a different problem what we are experiencing in the border of Texas and Mexico. The southern border of the United States is the area where children from Central America are coming to the United States. And these unaccompanied minors are processed in processing centers that are not akin to the detention centers that you're mentioning in the pre-deportation detentions that they're getting. These children are coming there. As they come in, they get stripped from their clothing. They get a uniform from the center. They take away their teddy bears, their blankets, and they are put in a plastic bag. And once they are processed, they get released to a relative or some person that they have identified, that they have a contact with, and that the Customs and Border Patrol have identified that will take them. This process takes no more than 72 hours, because at the rate that they were going when I visited the last time in December, they were getting about 1,000 a day. So they simply don't have enough space there to hold that many children. As they go out, there are buses that have been contracted by the community. These are people in the communities of Harlingen, Del Rio, and McAllen, that on a volunteer basis, they take these children to different churches. I visited the Sacred Heart Church and Respite Center. The volunteers line up in two rows as the children and families walk in to greet them with applause to make them feel welcome.
Mm-hmm.
So as the children are embedded into the community, I think that we need to think that these children do not immigrate. They flee. These families that have sent their children up north have made the heart-wrenching decision of sending their children away to save them from a death from bullet or hunger. They come to this country with credible fear. They are coming to a country that is not contiguous to their country, which is one of the conditions for them to be considered refugees. And I think that we as a society have to ask ourselves if we are our brother's keeper. These children are coming from very difficult circumstances. One of the images that I'm trying to erase from my mind, but I cannot, is many of them come in with their T-shirts, and their name has been painted on the T-shirt, and a telephone number has also been painted across the T-shirt. That usually represents a relative or a person they know that is willing to take the child in this country.
It's hard to believe this is actually happening here in America. And what is the American Academy of Pediatrics recommending to the government, in particular to the administrator of ICE, to help protect these vulnerable children from being re-traumatized?
We believe that children should not be placed in detention centers. We think that children should be in the community. These children are not criminals. they are running away from criminals, and they are being treated as criminals. And I don't remember who said the famous saying that not everything that is legal is moral, and not everything that is moral is legal. But these children become illegals because of a written law somewhere, not because of an act that they deliberately did, knowing that they would violate a law, except running for their lives.
Dr. Fernando Stein is a pediatrician. He's also a native of Guatemala, and he is currently the medical director at the Progressive Care Unit at the Texas Children's Hospital in Houston, and he is speaking as the president of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Dr. Stein, thank you very much for taking time to talk with us today.
Thank you.
At Indiana University, the number of students with autism has increased tenfold in the past decade. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Peter Ballin and Rosen looks at how they're adjusting, beginning with a visit to a cooking class at the College Internship Program, also known as CIP.
I'm Reagan Roush, and I'm about to cook some creamy chicken fajita pasta.
Okay, so Reagan's going to work on the spices.
Looks like they came pretty well mixed.
Looks good.
I am a sophomore at IU. When I got that acceptance letter, what came through my head was, am I really going to be able to do this? This is going to be very different. I never really cooked before moving down here. It's another step to reaching full independence.
So you're all done with the peppers, onions, and chicken is all done?
Yeah, it's really sizzling now. I first moved into CIP around 2 weeks after my first day at IU. It's an organization helping students on the autism spectrum, and I initially needed a ton of help from the staff. I needed help, me and my professors, to get accommodations. I needed to learn how to cook some basic things, and now I'm very independent compared to when I started here.
The pasta back in the pot, and then I think we add everything together and we should be good.
I'm taking the first bite. Biggest challenge about being on such a big campus is probably making friends. I'm in a much different situation than most of my peers. So it's kind of hard to relate with them. You can overcome your limits, but you'll have autism throughout your life. But you can still become a champion of it. You can still win.
Hi there.
Peter?
Yes, are you Marcy?
Yes.
Very nice to meet you.
My name is Marcy Wheeler. I'm a social worker here at the Indiana Resource Center for Autism. The social life for college students can be something that anybody deals with. You just kind of magnify that for somebody on the autism spectrum. People are realizing these folks are coming to colleges, and so things need to change to welcome and understand them better. I know this one student, Abe Shapiro. He came to some of the Student on the Spectrum Club meetings. He's reached out to a community he's involved in and organized a night for autism.
First one more. What we are going to be doing tonight is something pretty historical. What we are doing is Autism Awareness Shabbat Night hosted at the Helen G. Simon Hillel Center.
So I know that this Shabbat's a little different from the usual fare. This Autism Awareness Night is the first in the series. Just want to welcome you all and hope you enjoy it.
My name is Abe Shapiro. I am a freshman here at Indiana University. At the age of 3 years old, I was diagnosed with Asperger's and autism spectrum disorder. So I feel that this is not only important for me, but for my fellow spectrumites, if you will.
And please rise.
When I was younger, I wouldn't speak with people, and I'd ramble on and on about topics, something I still do, of course, but I've embraced it as a positive thing, not as a negative. One word, the way I feel about tonight is ecstatic. I feel that it went perfectly and that we've really brought awareness to an issue that's been ignored for a very long time.
That was cool.
Yeah, Jackie, that was a really cool service. I enjoyed it.
Each of those students deserve a place in our society, and they don't deserve to be ridiculed and categorized for something they can't control. Rather, the world should embrace them and accept them as one of their own.
So what's next?
I'll tell you what's next. I'm about to go get hopped up on some matzo ball soup right about now.
All right. Off to dinner.
That feature from Indiana Public Broadcasting education reporter Peter Ballinan-Rosen. Not long ago, a member of the staff of the Indiana Department of Child Services here in Lake County had a chance to talk with the Indiana Parenting Institute and a group of people that the IPI had put together to talk about discipline, abuse, poverty, neglect, and a lot of other issues as well, too. Ellis Dumas is with us to talk about what he talked about before the group not long ago. And Ellis, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Well, first off, tell us a little bit about the job that you perform for the Indiana Department of Child Services here in Lake County and how it was, I guess, because of your expertise, the IPI asked you to talk with them not long ago.
Yes. So I'm currently the regional manager for Department of Child Services here in Lake County, which is also Region 1. We are our own region. And it's a very unique situation. Mostly throughout the state, we're broken up into 18 regions, but multiple counties with each region. Only us and Marion are our own region. That's because of sheer size and numbers, quite naturally. And so, being over at the Department of Child Services here in Region 1, we have a pretty big office, second largest region in the state. And so we often go out throughout the community and do speaking engagements, but the Indiana Parenting Institute asked for us to do more so kind of a dialogue around these topics of abuse and neglect, poverty versus neglect, and kind of what is inappropriate discipline or where those lines kind of fall into. And it's always a great opportunity when the community wants to engage in conversation to make sure that they understand the laws and ramifications behind taking next steps.
Does the question come up, especially when it involves discipline and abuse and poverty and neglect here? We have, especially here in Lake County, we have such a disproportionate number of families that are financially insecure or poor. I guess in some cases, they certainly meet the federal guidelines for poverty and the like here. And we find there's this unfortunate correlation in some cases, not all, but in some cases, between discipline and the possibility of child abuse and child neglect.
Well, yeah, and so first, talking about poverty, the one thing we want to be careful with is not mistaking poverty for neglect or neglect for poverty.
Mm-hmm.
The one big thing that we have as a resource is our prevention side, which is our community partners here in our region, where we can help families without involvement with the Department of Child Services. Our goal is to keep that family intact and keep that family as whole. And so if it's a matter of resources, those resources are available, and as well as a number of resources we have in this great community. So that's one of the things we try to focus on when we're looking at that aspect of neglect versus poverty. And you can't really say in some aspects just because a person's means they're not appropriately caring for or providing the well-being of their child. And so we have to take each individual case individually and on a single hand and look at and evaluate and assess the situation without kind of bulking them together. But when it comes to abuse and neglect, we want to make sure that we too, we're empowering that parent. We don't want to take away the parent's inability to parent their children. That's not our goal. Our primary goal is to protect children who have been abused and neglected. That's pretty much what it comes in at. And so we kind of lay things out as to what the law states in regards to discipline and the appropriateness of it. And we tell them there is a thin line and a true delicate factor that we have to think about and consider. And we always ask them to be considerate of that.
Now, we know it's difficult any time of the year, I suppose, that any problem can come up if it's severe enough, it could push somebody over the edge, so to speak. But I would imagine this time of year is especially bad. We've gone through Thanksgiving. We have the Christmas holiday season coming up here, and it's a lot of stress and a lot of problems for a lot of families. And it doesn't matter, I guess, even in your income level or how you are as a parent, it still can be very difficult.
Exactly. Well, this time of year is relatively almost always difficult for, like you said, stressors, families who can't afford Christmas gifts, or not even just they can't afford the bad holidays. Sometimes the holidays bring along bad memories of lost loved ones and add additional stressors to the family, and sometimes that results in that abuse and neglect. One of the things that we're trying to proactively do and engage the community in is something like we do right now with our toy drive, mm-hmm. providing toys to children so that we decrease that level of anxiety or concern or how to be able to make a Christmas for my child or Thanksgiving for my child, which is why we partner with the community to have these baskets and things like that throughout the community. The most we can do is make sure we're there before it happens. But when we can prevent it in some aspects, being there to report it thereafter.
We're talking with Ellis Dumas, who is the manager of Region 1 for the Indiana Department of Child Services. And Region 1, by the way, is Lake County. Lake County by itself, as a matter of fact. And he was able to speak recently to a cultural competence dialogue that was established by the Indiana Parenting Institute to talk about issues about the issues of discipline and abuse, about poverty and neglect here. We've been talking about some of the particular points here. When you had a chance to talk not only in your open discussion to everybody in that room that day, but I guess you had a chance to get involved in some other roundtable discussions as well, too. What were some of the things that I guess you and your colleagues and other people involved in the IPI had a chance to talk about that kind of get them prepared for this time of year and just in general about the issues of dealing with the difference between abuse and proper discipline or what parents feel are discipline?
Well, the one big thing we have to put an emphasis on, a lot of people do not know, is that we only assess or look into abuse allegations in regards to a parent or caregiver. Mm-hmm. And so if we always give the common example, if the neighbor comes across your street and decides to physically discipline your child or hit your child, but that person is not a parent or caregiver, that will be something we will refer back over to law enforcement because it's not abuse and neglect in which we would assess. However, you as a parent or a caregiver or acting as a babysitter, daycare facilities, teachers fall in that caregiver role. Those are items in which we assess for abuse and neglect. The other big question that always comes up is that where is the threshold in which I can use corporal punishment? And I tell everyone, we can't really say there's no black and white matter in saying that you can hit your child three times in an hour. That just doesn't exist. Each individual child is unique, and each situation is delicate. The law does allow for use of discipline towards your child. It doesn't prohibit it. It's just there's a threshold in which you cannot cross over when you leave bruised, cuts, welts, broken bones, things like that, mm-hmm. That we have an obligation to assess.
I suppose, too, mentioned it also depends a lot on how old the child is or the children
exactly.
are. Yeah.
Exactly. I will be hard-pressed to say that I've ever come across a situation where we saw where there's an appropriate matter in which an infant should be disciplined, physically disciplined. So that's just one of those things where you have to, like I said, every single situation is unique by itself.
When you finished up the discussion, talking with the IPI group, did you leave any tips or any bits of advice from your experience over the years working not only in your professional experience as well as working with the Indiana DCS?
Well, I one of the biggest things I always share is that we as a lot of individuals there's no book for how to parent in many cases, and the books that are out there for how to parent really probably don't give a lot of people a lot of answers. And so a lot of people are trying this. It's their first child or their first go-around. And so as a community, we cannot be afraid to ask for guidance or help. That's how you factor in that prevention matter. That's why the resources are out there. That's why our community partners is there. We say you can call them, and it's not going to tie back to a case or anything like that to say, I want to get your advice on this. Don't be afraid to ask for help. Sometimes I feel like as a society, we don't ask for enough help when the resources are there for us. And then, two, I tell people all the time, one of the common things is that everyone was very well pleased, but as a community, we have an obligation to report child abuse and neglect. As an agency, we're only as good as the community in which we serve. You are the ones that are out there seeing the concerns for the children. You are the one who lay eyes on the children every single day. And so if you don't report it, sometimes we can't find out what's going on in our community, and that's how we protect our children.
Now, on that point alone, do you find that you're having better success, that more people are reporting problems than in the past?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think as a community, we've done one thing is made it a point to hit every single school for talking about abuse and neglect in Lake County. You know, we have a lot of them, Chris. So it took us about a year and a half to get around to all of them. And we're now making our rounds on the charter schools and some private schools. But we have an obligation to report. And so since having those conversations and people having the ability, one, to know who's working here in the local office, that they can reach out if they have these questions or concerns. And the biggest advice I always tell everyone, when in doubt, you can make a report. That's what our hotline's for. They have a screening tool that if it doesn't meet legal sufficiency, we cannot go out and assess. But if there is enough of a concern, we have an obligation to go out and assess.
We've been talking with Alice Dumas, who is the manager of Region 1, which is Lake County, of the Indiana Department of Child Services. And as it turns out, both Lake and Marion counties are their own separate districts, their own separate regions, rather, because of their size and the complexity of the cases that come into the DCS. Alice had a chance recently to talk with the Indiana Parenting Institute in one of their little workshops, their cultural competence dialogue, as they called it at the time. Thanks very much for taking time to talk with us today.
Quantum Leap Soundbites, brought to you by Indiana Humanities. This series is a part of Indiana Humanities' Quantum Leap Initiative, which invites Hoosiers to explore and celebrate the spirit of possibility and problem-solving that occurs when we bridge the humanities with science, technology, engineering, and math. On this week's episode, we'll be traveling to a place of Hoosier ingenuity and invention. In this scientific laboratory, major discoveries were made that lay the groundwork for everything we know today about genetics. This lab we're exploring isn't fancy, and it's not in some sleek, futuristic-looking building. It's in an attic. Yes. Today we are exploring Salvador E. Luria's attic lab in Kirkwood Hall at Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana, in the 1940s. Before Salvador Luria came onto the genetic scene, the scientific community didn't know much about DNA. Luria and most other geneticists were fascinated by the book What is Life? By Erwin Schrödinger, which compiled all the available knowledge at the time about genetics. It included things like chromosomes, mutations, and cell reproduction. Luria was inspired by all of the questions that had not yet been answered in the field of genetics and set out to make his mark. It was well known in the scientific community in the 1930s that we could learn more about genetics if only we found the tiniest living organism possible to do experiments on. That's because the tinier and simpler the life form, the easier it is to learn about DNA. And out of all the geneticists in the world searching for the best organism to use, Luria is the one who found it. He was the first person to ever use bacteriophages to study genetics. Bacteriophages are tiny viruses that only infect bacteria. Bacteriophages are much smaller than bacteria themselves. They're only a few nanometers across. That means that the head of a pin is about a million times bigger than a bacteriophage. Luria designed the most significant experiment of his career using bacteriophages during a faculty dance at Indiana University Bloomington. He was near a slot machine that caused him to wonder how he chanced. Observed that a person can't win at a slot machine every time they pull the lever. There must be a pattern to winning and losing. He thought that maybe this pattern of winning and losing was like the pattern of some bacteria developing resistance to bacteriophages and some not. He wondered if bacteria mutate and develop resistance by chance, like winning a slot machine, or mutate because they are exposed to bacteriophages. The following morning, Luria ran to his attic lab that he shared with two students and 18 rabbits. There he began experimenting to see whether bacteria randomly mutated or if they mutated because of the bacteriophages around them. A famous scientist, Max Delbruck, helped Luria create the mathematical component of the experiment. Together they discovered that bacteria do mutate randomly, and this discovery was huge. It showed that bacteria and viruses have DNA that tells them what to do, just like all other living things. This experiment was called the fluctuations test, and it showed that bacteriophages and bacteria were perfect to study genetics on. And there, in Luria's attic lab, the field of molecular biology was born. Though Luria had just founded the field of molecular biology, by the United States government, he was considered an enemy alien. That's because Luria was experimenting in his attic lab during World War II, and he was a Jewish refugee from Italy, a country that the U.S. was at war with. But regardless of how he was labeled, Bloomington was a place of scientific and personal growth for Luria. In his attic lab, he mentored the budding scientist James Watson, who later discovered the structure of DNA along with Francis Crick. And outside the lab, he was growing and learning too. Luria met and married his wife Zella in 1945. And through his roommate, a scholar of English literature, Luria became fascinated with the humanities. Humanities became such an important part of Luria's life that in 1985 he told a reporter, "Scientists who exile themselves from the arena of social struggles were failing the societies they were supposed to serve." Later in his career at MIT, he even taught a world literature class in addition to his courses on bacteriology. During Luria's 45 years as a research scientist, he won the Nobel Prize in Physiology, was president of the American Society for Microbiology, and founded and directed the Cancer Center at MIT. Indiana Humanities connects people, opens minds, and enriches lives by creating and facilitating programs that encourage Hoosiers to think, read, and talk. This has been Quantum Leap Soundbites, and I'm Sondra Burton.
Well, even though we got some late season snow here in the region, we're still on the brink of change in seasons. That means outdoor music. Here's Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson.
For those who love music and relaxing in beautiful surroundings, the best of both can be enjoyed at Ravinia Festival. The venue, straight up I-94 in Highland Park, Illinois, is now doing its big unveiling of who's coming for the 2017 season. It offers music genres across the board, from classical to bluegrass to classic rock to rock alternative to rap and more. Ravinia President and CEO Wells Kaufman is the one who creates the schedule, and just talking with him about that part of his job offers great insights into how it all comes together.
And you told me before that you plugged in the Chicago Symphony Orchestra first.
They're always first because the classical artists book earlier than anyone else, and because the symphony's time period with us is usually prescribed at least 3 years in advance, sometimes up to 5 years in advance. So we just signed a new 8-year contract with the orchestra, and we know when we're going to have them all the way through 2026. That might change a little bit if they go to Europe on tour or whatever it might be. But that allows me to start the planning, because one of the trickiest things to do in any summer orchestral season is to book conductors, because they're in great demand. And many of them like to be with their families or take some time off, you know, it's summer vacation, whatever it might be. Or maybe they just want to stay in Europe and do festivals there. So you're always on the lookout for great conductors to be able to come. And I do that not in an advice consent situation with the downtown CSO colleagues that I have, but we like to know what each other's doing so that we don't step on each other's feet.
Kaufman says it's always been a part of the Ravinia tradition to book top acts, but the people who come to Ravinia are also very interested in discovering something new. And now, Kaufman says, another ceiling has been shattered for women.
Our audiences want to see the new hot young talent out there, which is just off the charts, blooming. Not only because there's great training out there and wonderful musicians, but we now actually let women conduct, heaven forbid. And people of color.
And why was that such a big deal to let women and people of color conduct?
Oh, my goodness, it just didn't happen. It was a old white guy business with old white guy agents and old white guy managers. It's kind of the last bastion, in a bad way, of sexism and racism. But that's all been blown up, which is great.
When was that blown up?
I would say it started to happen there always have been women conductors even back into the 19th century, but...
Scandalous.
Yeah. I would say, in America, one would look to someone like Maren Alsop, who is the music director in Baltimore, and one was one of the final proteges of Leonard Bernstein. And even Bernstein in the 50s and 60s thought that women just shouldn't conduct. There's no talent, it was just, they never went down that path. But of course, he was one of the great teachers of all time, and taught at Tanglewood, taught in Indiana, taught at the Hollywood Bowl. And he started to see the talent that was coming up, and women were given a chance.
Kaufman says it used to be the norm for there to be very little diversity or no diversity among conductors.
For a long time, there weren't conductors of color. There was Eduardo Mata of Mexican descent, who was the music director in Dallas. There was a couple of African-American conductors, one Marilyn Horne's husband, and the other, the longtime music director, James DePriest, in Portland, Oregon, who you would see on the podium.
Now, diversity among conductors is much more frequent because the world is looking to be more diverse in general, and it also helps make the pool more diverse when teachers keep an open mind about who will be their students.
Also, in Finland, there's one of the great conducting teachers of all time, and he's always accepted women in his class. Susanna Malki, one of those women who's been to us before and will come to us this summer.
Having music education programs across the world also has left a big impact on the conductors we see today, some of who are performing at Ravinia Festival this season.
Out of Venezuela, for the last 40, 45 years, the Sistema program there has blossomed a whole new crop of orchestra musicians, but also conductors, the biggest, most famous exponent being Gustavo Dudamel, who's the music director in Los Angeles, and will be making his Ravinia debut this summer. He's in his 30s, good-looking, great hair, great musician, and people are just crazy about him. So,
Kaufman's 30 years in the business helps in bringing new talent to Ravinia.
Which doesn't automatically mean you know more, but it does mean you have that bigger network. And it's a small world, and so people share information pretty freely.
So, in sharing some information with you, some of the artists that are making their Ravinia debut, and they include Sammy Hagar in The Circle, Common, Ryan Speedo Green, and Adam Nielsen, Fitz in the Tantrums, James Arthur, Garbage, they are appearing with Blondie, Darius Rucker, Radney Foster, I'm With Her, Alanis Morissette, John Mellencamp, Pentatonix, Michael Bolton, TLC, and Stevie Nicks. And that's just some of the debut artists. There's a ton more artists who are coming back, including Tony Bennett, the Moody Blues, the Beach Boys with the Temptations, Boz Scaggs with Michael McDonald, Diana Krall, and that doesn't even cover them all as we don't have that much time in radio. Kaufman predicts it's going to be a very exciting season. He loves his job, and rightfully so. Bringing great art to the people is as fulfilling as his previous job working in Atlanta for Jimmy Carter. Wait, what?
You work for Jimmy Carter in Atlanta?
I did. He has something called the Atlanta Project there at the Carter Center, which was his dream to eradicate poverty in Atlanta. And I worked on that with him there for an arts component to that bigger social, I wouldn't say social engineering, but social welfare program, largely for the black community there.
A train ride on the South Shore to downtown Chicago and then the Union Pacific North Line gets you to Ravinia Festival. In fact, it stops literally right at the front gate. In Highland, Illinois, for Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Sharon Jackson. As it's carried across the waves, you're already falling. It's calling you back to face the music and the song that is coming through.
At the State House, members of the public, mostly trade organization members and lobbyists, got together to testify before Indiana Senate members on Tuesday on the comprehensive road funding bill. And Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith tells us that the testimony seemed to be similar to testimony it was given in the Indiana House earlier this session.
As in the House testimony, groups like the Indiana Chamber of Commerce and construction trade unions testified in support of higher fuel taxes and new fees to pay for roads. And groups like the Central Indiana Tea Parties and convenience store owners spoke in opposition. Those against include Americans for Prosperity's Justin Stevens, who opposes giving the governor authority to explore tolling.
From your perspective as legislators, this makes it a little easier to pass this tolling through this bill and then allow all the accountability efforts to fall on the executive. But I believe that's a disservice to the people that you were elected by.
Now, while the House was largely comfortable with tolling, the Senate might not be. Republican Senator Brant Hirschman, who chaired the hearing, says he'll explore curtailing the bill's broad tolling authority.
I don't anticipate moving a bill out of this committee that favors tolling of existing interstates.
The committee is expected to hear amendments and vote on the bill next week. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. The Federal Reserve Board meets today. We'll hear from Federal Board Chairman Janet Yellen as to what happens with interest rates. And we'll have Northwest Indiana Financial Advisor Greg Hammer with us on the show tomorrow to talk about what kind of impact any more increases in interest rates will have on your money. That's coming up tomorrow on Regionally Speaking.